And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies,
the secret oaths,
and the secret proceedings.
The show that asks questions about why we don't ask questions.
What the hell is going on?
This is Conspiracy Queries with Alan Parr. Welcome to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. I am Alan Park, and these are complex neuropsychiatric diagnostics. Or wait a minute, these are conspiracy queries. The complex neuropsychiatric diagnostics are something that my guest today, Dr. John Liebert, studies. He is also very knowledgeable in advanced psychopharmacology combined with psychotherapy of patients who have suspected histories of traumatic stress disorder. In other words, guys that came back from military deployments, pretty much. These fellows suffer from violent outbursts, suicides, suicidal violence towards others, etc. This Dr. John Liebert has interviewed many, many of these people, and he's an expert, and we're going to spend a little time with him today talking about the mindset where one becomes in the place where they're going to go around with a gun and kill people at Fort Hood or at Fort Hood or at Virginia Tech or at all of these other places where military men have then taken a gun and cut down their fellow citizens. Why is this happening? How can we stop it? Is there anything that can be done short of reassessing our entire overseas military operations? I don't know the answer to these questions, but Dr. John Liebert is going to help us get there. So here he is. Well, here we are, and Dr. John Liebert is with us, and he is going to discuss with us his book called Wounded Minds, and you can get that at Skyhorse Press. And Wounded Minds discusses why PTSD, also known as post-traumatic stress disorder, is on the rise. And why is that a fact that it leads to violent crime, such as the Fort Hood shooting? Now, you may be listening to this in a pre-recorded fashion rather than on the original broadcast. And if that's the case, you might wonder which Fort Hood killing we're thinking about. Yeah, there's more than one killing at Fort Hood. This emergency is also something that the doctor discusses in his book, and he's here now. Welcome to the show, doctor.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be there.
Great. Well, thanks for coming on. Tell us about a little bit about your background originally, how you wound up in the field that you're now in.
Well, it goes back a long ways. I happen to be one of the first of the doctor draft for Vietnam. In the early 60s, and was a flight surgeon in transports during that war. Got out. Was the chief resident at the Seattle Veterans Hospital during my residency and training in psychiatry at the peak of the Vietnam War. And then I got involved with, became somewhat of a police psychiatrist, and at that time a lot of policemen were being recruited. There weren't any victory parades, but the police departments were meeting the returning veterans at the air bases where they were returning, like Travis and McCord up in Tacoma.
So you were investigating.
They were recruiting them, and at that time, policemen didn't have to go to the academy, and the riots were very very disturbing to the chiefs because they didn't have the manpower to handle the riots. And
so let me just ask you this: you were discussing or investigating people who were police officers returning from Vietnam. Is that what you're talking
about? That's how I really got started on this. Yes, because these were men that were just really with the jets that had replaced our prop transports. It was no longer 5 days to get over to Vietnam. It was like one day. So these guys literally were pretty fresh out of combat, and and they were recruited for the police department for riot duty in places, Seattle and other cities, but I'm just familiar with Seattle, and it's where I was practicing.
And you found to find that a lot of these guys were mentally messed up, but they were already on the job acting as police officers. It shouldn't be a surprise.
I didn't find them, you know, I'm not sure they were messed up when they first came back. I mean, they didn't have psychological exams. It was a different era. And if you can meet the physical requirements, you could shoot straight, you were in. And then they would just kind of get on the job training, walk the beat for a while. And, of course, there were snipers and bombings and everything. And so, you know, the force was happy to have them with them, you know, at that time. They were out on the street within, you know, days. Hmm. Now, stuff happened. They turned out to be, you know, really very good police officers, and they really weren't trigger happy, you know. But there were incidents that happened that caused them to flare up and go into reliving states that they really weren't aware of because they were just literally out of combat. One of them was, you know, firing tear gas at the University of Washington at his own peers who didn't go to Vietnam, and I mean, he just lost his total sense of time and was you know, back in Vietnam, you know, thinking that he was, you know, firing off mortar shells, and then eventually he got into some psychiatric problems, and a lot of these guys ultimately left, but they hung in there for quite a while. They got through the riots and everything. So that's how pretty much I got to learn a lot about it, because we didn't have any diagnosis for post-traumatic stress disorder when I was in the military or when I was the chief resident at the Veterans Hospital. It came later, that's when I really developed some expertise, and then I tried to stay on top of it. Testified in Congress in 1994 about it, and then did some Gulf War syndrome examinations to learn about that, and then finally, in 2008, I was retained by the military to do fitness for duty examinations on soldiers returning from the surge in Iraq.
Right.
That brings me up today.
Okay, so that's where we are. And this is the most recent experience there. What helped you, what led to your creation of the book Wounded Minds?
That, you know, my experience with, you know, soldier after soldier after soldier out of that surge is what had the, you know, most profound influence on me, although I was prepared for it before as a result of seeing all these guys from Vietnam. But, you know, I got tuned in. I was able to dial into a different environment and start learning, you know, what was different about this and why this war has been so dangerous.
Well, we'll go into that later. I've got lots of thoughts on that myself, but answer this. Why is it that PTSD is on the rise in the military, in that we are told we have a military that, you know, is seemingly able to, at the drop of a hat, invade another country, whether or not there's a declaration of war, whether or not the country is sovereign, etc.? And it seems like it's they've facilitated invasion and occupation to make it a lot more simple than it used to be. So why is there more PTSD for the soldiers that are in these other countries coming back? Just being better diagnosed?
I don't think the research that's been done on post-traumatic stress disorder in the military is really of very much value. I think that the conclusions are basically, you know, designed to meet the needs of the contract.
Of the military, sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, I the closest we came was the Triangle Study back in the 80s on Vietnam veterans and that was a pretty flawed study too, but that came up with pretty close to a 50% if you include partial syndromes, whatever they meant by that. So, you know, I would start there instead of dialing back to one out of six. It depends on when you look at these guys, how you look at them, et cetera. The statistics are highly questionable. I'm not sure, therefore, that post-traumatic stress disorder has increased in prevalence from the Vietnam War or not, or from the Korean War, I should say, none of which has been like a popular war.
Right.
World War II, I do believe, was different. I do think that there were less long-term casualties in World War II because, you know, the further these guys got into Europe or further these guys got into Japan, you know, the more they saw the atrocities and they had a mission, they had a cause, and they got angrier and angrier, and it was, you know, a more just war. And they had time behind the lines. And when they were behind the lines, it was safe because they really were liberating countries. So, you know, they could go outside the wire and be safe. Vietnam was known as a 360 war, and just walking in towards a tree or walking in the jungle was very dangerous because of tripwires and booby traps, etc. This war, you can't even sleep without your buddy over your head having your back because you don't know if you're going to get blown away in your sleep by somebody inside. It's even more dangerous.
Yeah. Now, tell me, doctor, we've just had another shooting at Fort Hood. It seems like, so recently was the previous one. I actually had to look it up. It was in 2009. Mm-hmm. And we also have the military almost immediately. I mean, it's astounding. It's almost the first thing out of their mouth as soon as someone gets over there with a microphone. The violence will ensue. And just like the Navy Yards, even recently, and almost the first thing is, this has nothing to do with the military. There's nothing to do with the military that has anything to do with this.
Of course, it has everything to do with
the
military.
Of course.
You know, in the Navy Yard shooting, Aaron Alexis was, you know, shooting up the street in Seattle before he was even recruited. He was, I think, grossly psychotic in the Navy. That wasn't the Navy's fault, but he certainly shouldn't have been recruited. And then they were stuck with him, he shot up some more. And, I don't mean drugs. I mean gunfire.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
Got a pattern of misconduct. So they must have negotiated a discharge, giving him an honorable discharge. He should have had a medical evaluation board because he was grossly psychotic at the time. He had a delusion of a microchip being in his brain. And he went to the VA hospital after he was discharged, and they wouldn't take it out. And he went to another one right before he went to the Navy Yard. And then finally he carved it in his rifle butt that he was going to take care of matters himself, and he did. At least he got the microchip out of his brain. In that respect, I think they take some responsibility in knowing that, or should have known, that he was grossly psychotic and should have been medically boarded out.
But this is the thing that drives me crazy, because it is something that they are, you know, pushing aside, and it is something that is, it shows a rife imbalance in the way we govern ourselves.
Well, the problem is that with this all-volunteer army, these guys have contracts with the United States government, and part of that contract is medical and pension responsibilities. I mean, they basically sign a contract, and the government, you know, basically takes responsibility for caring for them in the event of a disabling injury for the rest of their life. can come into, you know, like $1-2 million over the a period of lifetime. And consequently, there's a lot of pressure, in my opinion, you know, to get these people either to stay on base and not get into trouble like they did with the Navy Yard shooter. He stayed in way too long. This guy's history, Lopez, you're going to find out more about him at Fort Bliss and El Paso than Fort Hood, because he had just recently transferred into Fort Hood. I don't think they really knew him very well. Mm. But on his Facebook, even though they're kind of, you know, minimizing his combat, at first the general said he was in combat, and then it's all been watered down. He wasn't, not exposed, et cetera. But I'd like to bring your attention, or your audience's attention, to his Facebook posting a couple of years ago.
This is
with his time in Iraq, celebrating life. It has been exactly 1 year and 2 days since I left Iraq, seeing in Fallujah the most brutal explosion. I was left paralyzed and started a discussion over the radio. I was only focused on breathing deeply so that I don't lose focus and continue the mission. Those were hours of agony, waiting for an attack by the insurgency, but we were able to exit Fallujah all alive. I was in vehicle number 6. The worst was that number 5 was a diesel truck, the perfect target, and I was only thinking about getting back with my family. To be in the line of fire is, there's a cuss word that's living there, but even more, it's the suffering of families. Now that's, and then the general is now saying there's no specific evidence of his being exposed to combat. I believe this is very specific evidence. And they've had 2 years, you know, to rule this in or rule this out, because the Army has what's called a battlefield report. I mean, either this happened or it didn't happen. And if it didn't happen, that should have been ruled out a long time ago. Now, this guy, we're led to understand, has been under, you know, evaluation for post-traumatic stress for a long time. Well, in order to do that, you have to tell what's the trauma. This must have been the trauma. Also, it's a blast injury. He's also a self-reported traumatic brain injury. Well, I don't know if it's self-reported. It looks to me like he did have a traumatic brain injury.
And it doesn't stop there. Doctor, here's what I don't like about it. I mean, this has been going on for so long in the way of the, let's just say, the Iraq war, that the numbers of soldiers dying is on an upward trajectory all the way through, like before the surge and then at the surge. And there's always this rah-rah, let's support the troops at the front end of, like, to get foment interest in the war and a belief and an acceptance that we're okay to do this. And then, boy, they just back off at the other end of things, don't they? I mean, they're just like snotted-up Kleenexes.
When it's time to cough up and pay for a pension, they're off of it, you know? You're supposed to come in for, do your time, take the shots, do the deployments, and leave quietly. And you know, you can use your VA grants to buy a house or go to college. That is, if you can stand up, or if you can concentrate enough to apply for a job, or even if you can get a job.
Why do people still sign up then? I mean, here, well, like, what you're saying is akin to this.
This is a little different cohort of soldier that we have, and we have a couple million now since 9/11, most of whom have had multiple deployments. Now, in Vietnam, remember, there was, you know, 1 year, and you couldn't be sent back. There were few exceptions to that. You could volunteer to go back, but you couldn't be sent back, okay? This is an all-volunteer Army, and the deployments are in the 3-4, even more, area, because they volunteered.
But are things that bad that someone looks at this as a job? I mean, the front end, as I said, is taken care of, but if I'm able to learn this before I sign up and I realize, oh, but geez, if I If I go through a few horrible things, there's no help for me at the other end. And then we look at the wars from the distance of, you know, when the initial invasion took place. And from what I understand, there's not a whole hell of a lot of improvement going on over there, just a lot of contractor money spent, and including these guys coming back all messed up. Now, the way I look at it is this. I could probably, if I were able to concentrate and maybe call in a few favors, I could probably get myself a pretty nice secondhand Porsche or something of that nature, and I could make that happen. What I can't do is consistently shell out for the insurance payments and even the oil changes on a higher-end vehicle like that. So even though I can afford the vehicle, I cannot afford the maintenance. And I think this is what the U.S. has done with the military. They can't really afford the invasions, but they put the soldiers into it anyway, and then when they're going to cut corners, it's on that guy's health. And meanwhile, the rest of us are told, support this, you know, come on, we got to go to Syria, etc. And I mean, right, at one point, where does the soldier, the potential soldier, realize, I'm just going to get screwed on this deal and I'm not going to go?
Well, and then, I don't know, there's AWOLs out there. I don't know if it matches the AWOL rate in Vietnam, which was like one whole division eventually. I don't know if it's that high, but there are plenty of AWOLs, away without leaves, out there.
Well, maybe they just don't want to be DEADs.
They just left. You know? I don't know if they're actively searching for them. In Vietnam, they just gave up and forgot about them, you know. And some of them went to Canada, some of them went to Mexico, et cetera. But, you know, they're out there. And then, of course, there are the suicides, so that's another way out. And, of course, there are guys who just get kicked out, plenty of them. Yes, I think that the all-volunteer army is expendable, and it's going to be more expendable as it downsizes for financial reasons.
Right. And then so the real comfort is given to the soldier of fortune, the mercenary.
Well, seems there like are those in there, too. I mean, there are foreign nationals in this army, they have promises or expectations of becoming citizens. But I wouldn't say it's a mercenary army, but I worry about that. I'm quite frankly, the draft was a failure for Vietnam. And in my opinion, this all-volunteer army, not the soldiers, not the combat. It's a good army, but the concept, I believe, is as big a failure as the draft. I don't believe in this all-volunteer army.
Well, I guess I think part of the problem with it as well is that it is designed. These incursions are based on lies, and I think it's really time for everybody who's been listening to mainstream media for the past 10 to 12 years to figure that out, and that these lies are, you know, egregious and have resulted in people dying. And so this is the problem that I have. If the war itself is thoroughly unnecessary and built on a lie, who is going to pay the price for these guys coming home all shredded and tattered mentally? I mean, this is a huge crime, and people want to spend more time thinking about much smaller items. But, I mean, the crux of America is, trust me, I'm your president. We have to invade this country. Please support me, my country, right or wrong. We're going to spend guys who we're going to get guys to do it, and they're good old Americans. And then when they come back, we're not going to take care of them or whatever. But that's fine, and just believe in this. And that seems to be the whole motto of America 2014 these days.
It was the model that Eisenhower addressed in 1966. He said it's unfair. It discriminates against the less fortunate. In this case, it's the rural kids and the Hispanics more than the inner city kids like in Vietnam. But in any case, it's a promise to kids to get out of the dead end towns. That are going nowhere, and you know, get them the benefits and education so that they can move up in life. And, of course, rarely does, well, I don't know how often it happens, but they pay a very, very high price to do this. And Eisenhower nailed the problem back in 1966 during right after the draft, called it discriminatory. And I would say that even though these are volunteers, I think the same, he would say the same today. And I think that he was right on in 1966. And to prevent what you're talking about, not being able to wait for new equipment to invade Iraq. I mean, it had to be done. We don't fight wars with what we want. We fight wars with what we got. So we went in there with used equipment. We couldn't even wait for the new equipment to be shipped in. That's a big question, why that was done, why we were fighting with inferior used equipment, because we had to go in so fast. That should be explained.
Because you run the government with inferior used politicians?
That equipment was not, you know, protected from IEDs.
Yeah.
And we're less likely to have these kinds of adventures overseas if we have universal military service, which is what I see no other alternative. You know, for a failure of the draft, and you know, in Vietnam, and the failure of becoming a failure in the all volunteer army.
What is that? A private? How would that work then?
Universal military service.
Sure.
It's just like Eisenhower said. There are no deferments. You graduate from high school and you go into the military for a period of time, a year or two, barring, of course, severe disability or severe criminal records. Are going to be exceptions, of
sure.
course.
Okay.
But all young males and females go into the military with a high school diploma. No show from, you know, for basic training with a high school diploma. You get a high school diploma and come back. No high school diploma, you go to jail.
Wow, and you're advocating this?
Universal military service, this is what Eisenhower recommended back in 1966. So if we all go, then we're less likely to go to places where we're going to get shot up and blown away.
Okay. Well, I can't agree that we all need to do the bidding of the military and do mandatory time there. And I have a different thoughts on how society should be structured.
We'll have more control,
yes,
over, you know, what's called the authorization for the use of military force. Are you in Canada?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I was in Montreal. I was in medical school in Montreal during the terrorist attacks up there, and Trudeau invoked the War Powers Act. You probably recall that.
Yes. For those who don't know, Trudeau was the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, and Quebec wanted to separate, like always, and we said no, and they had to deploy the guard to keep them here.
And it was a national kind of no-knock policy, so that if, you know, if there was an FLQ suspected in, you know, British Columbia, they could not no-knock. And, I mean, it was the War Powers Act. It's been revoked. We have something similar now since 9/11 called the Authorization for Use of Military Force. It has not been revoked. It gives the President of the United States extensive powers to do what is deemed necessary to prevent another attack.
But was this bill written in the wake of 9/11?
Yes.
Okay, but was it really? Or, I mean, was it a phenomenally detailed bill that chronologically would have been impossible to have written before 9/11? And as Michael Moore brought up with the other bill that was passed, the Patriot Act, I mean, most of these guys didn't even read the thing.
That's not unusual.
So, I mean,
in Washington, D.C.
You know, when you're living in a country where they don't read.
What did the congresswoman say about the health law? You know, we got to pass it so we can read it.
Right. I mean, that is ridiculous. I mean, you're passing bills that you haven't read to send guys to countries on wars based on a lie, so when they come home, you don't spend any time fixing them so they can go somewhere and start shooting people. And then everybody on CNN can wonder, you know, when are we going to ban guns? And it just seems like this ridiculous line of logic is more of an entertainment trope and a sort of a thing for people to spend time thinking about rather than actually solving the problem.
Well, I think the president needs to go back to Congress and get, reauthorized for the scope of further interventions,
But they can't. I mean,
we're doing.
His pick for medical chief is said something negative about gunplay once, and now the NRA is trying to stop this guy from being, there's too much lobbying power in control in the states. And I'm sure lots of that has to do with, weapons manufacturers and bullet manufacturers. And
video game manufacturers in Hollywood, you bet.
Well, there's that
and,
too,
The money flows in Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whose money it is because it's not real.
It's our money. It's the taxpayers' money. We're the only ones who pay.
Explain this to me regarding PTSD, which is what you are an expert on. You say here the medical literature states that forensic-style evaluation of PTSD, which I assume we are looking for to try to help these guys when they get back, can cause the forensic-style evaluation of PTSD can cause second injury.
I'm glad you mentioned that.
If it threatens to invalidate.
That's possibly what happened with Lopez. I don't know for sure, but I think that looking at Fort Hood for the answers to what happened with Lopez is like looking for Flight 370 in the Arctic Ocean. I think you need to go to Fort Bliss and find out, whether he was confronted with what I just read from his Facebook. Second injury is, guys like me coming at, guys like Lopez and saying, prove it. Prove that you were, you experienced all this. Which they don't have to do anymore, but they used to. They used to have to actually come in with the evidence that this happened. They don't have to do that anymore, but that doesn't mean that they're not doing it, and that is the second injury. It's the lack of validation, somebody going through what this guy describes on his Facebook doesn't need to be confronted with, did this really happen? Goddamn right it happened,
right?
Sounds pretty, the military is saying there's nothing specific. This sounds very specific to me. I was in vehicle 6. The vehicle 5 was a diesel truck. It sounds very specific to me. And that is second injury. It's not the post-traumatic stress disorder that causes the violence, but the confrontation by these forensic units in the military and the VA, that can cause it. And it's no different than what happened with the West German psychiatrists who were not Nazis, examining, victims of the Holocaust and taking somebody, 50 years old or 40 years old or whatever, who basically saw his whole family murdered and then took a childhood history and said, yes, but, he had, he was obviously he had bedwetting when he was a child, and he had to, he had to have special learning, support in grade school. He was sick before he was arrested when he was 8 years old and went to Auschwitz,
Wow.
And it's that kind of forensic intervention that's extremely damaging that causes the second injury, and it happened with the German restitution system and probably still is.
We're with Dr. John Liebert, and he has recently written a book called Wounded Minds about post-traumatic stress disorder and soldiers, and these suicide rates of I mean, this is happening to guys who are deployed in the field. And it's also happening when they come back home sometime later and sometimes may involve their wife and kids and what have you. And I guess this is just going to continue to happen because, I again say, if you're going to have a military intervention, you need to be able to afford everything about it. And that includes the protective clothing that the men are supposed to wear, and that includes the care they're supposed to get when they come home. And if you can't seem to get all of that together, then stop having wars, especially when they're based on lies. So how are we going to rationalize this away? What are we expecting to hear from the mainstream over time when another shooter does things based on the same MO and et cetera? And when we don't really get to the bottom of this issue, this problem's going to still – it's going to continue to happen.
Well, you know, there's a lot of points in that question, but one of them is very important, and that is the image that the American public might be getting falsely from the military, not directly but indirectly. The image that Lopez was being worked up and treated in a clinic lined by uniformed psychiatrists. I would be surprised if there is more than one uniformed psychiatrist on Fort Hood. And if you go into the clinics, which are called behavioral health clinics, you know, you're not likely to see a uniformed psychiatrist from the military who's been in the combat experience, et cetera.
Why is
he may
that?
Be around, you know, maybe in the inpatient unit or something like that.
And why is that?
But they're not in the clinics because there are not enough of them. These clinics are run by a whole variety of people, mostly civilians on contract, nurses, physician's assistant, you know, and yes, there is a psychiatrist director, that may or may not be a psychiatrist, I suspect, just to get somebody in uniform, you know, who can call downstairs, so to speak, and say, is there anybody in uniform in a clinic right now? You know, because, there's got to be somebody in uniform in those clinics. So, you know, who was working this guy up? Who was seeing the guy in the Navy who did these, you know, did the massacre? You know, it's not, you know, we need a doctor draft is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
We had plenty of doctors in, you know, in the Vietnam War. And now, you know, we don't have anywhere near enough for what we're doing.
It seems like it doesn't really matter as much anymore because it's more about the, you know, the Blackwaters and the providers. It seems to be like a moneymaker. And again, when you get into money spending, people are not as interested. They want to buy the incredibly powerful, supposedly, you know, missile that'll fly across four continents, but they don't want to sink the dough into making sure Joe Smith doesn't come back to Peoria and cut down half a shopping mall. They just, it seems like there's no, they don't care. I mean, that's where we're at.
Also, you know, there's something more active going on. I mean, I think that we need to take a look at how recruiters get paid and whether they were really, you know, during the time when our economy was cooking and we needed these, you know, soldiers, incentivized on numbers and, you know, bringing in people who were really unfit.
Is that the case?
Well, it's certainly been alleged that they've been incentivized for numbers. There's a question that should be raised about how VA administrators are incentivized and given bonuses. What are those based on? Are those based on some kind of performance? Are they based on reducing the number of compensable diagnoses? You have to remember that there's 250,000 VA claims for post-traumatic stress disorder right now in appeal, and it's expected there'll be another 250. That makes for 500,000
claims.
So, you know, we're looking for they're putting all the money, billions of dollars, into looking for the 1% who is probably fraudulent, malingering, or something, and seeking, compensation for an incident in war.
Well, that's pretty daunting. I guess it doesn't. How does it make you feel that the attempt and the need and the rush to go to war? It seems like we're just there all the time now. You know, after Afghanistan.
I wish somebody would come up with a better solution, but the only decent solution I've heard is that of Dwight Eisenhower back in 1966, and I don't think anything's changed. We need to go to uniform military training and service, where, you know, we all go or nobody goes. We have to decide what our borders are. Is our border, in Sochi, Russia, or Crimea, or I think our border is in Cuba, because that's awful close. I think our border is I mentioned this in Canada one time, and people laughed, and I couldn't understand why they were like, I think our border is with Canada, but I wasn't talking about the border between the United States and Canada, the Anchor Line. I'm talking about the Arctic Ocean that's open now.
Right, with the Russians.
That's our border.
The North American border.
Yeah. I mean, it's open now. There's a Northwest Passage, and who's up there? The Russians, the Chinese, they're all up there.
Mm-hmm. Well, what are we going to tell people the next time there's a military shooting and hundreds of thousands of people believe the military when they say, it's not our fault. We didn't do it. It's nothing to do with us. How can we make people understand that it's absolutely not the case and that the opposite is true?
I don't know, but I can tell you that the general that came on after this happened was pretty careful and had already been briefed on what he said. And what he said is being watered down and watered down and watered down until now. All we have is some jerk of a soldier who got into an argument over his leave. Like, you would go to your boss and say, hey, I'd like to take a couple extra days off. And he says, no, so you go on a shooting rampage. I mean, give me a break.
Yeah.
This guy had a history. It's just that he was new at Fort Hood. Nobody knew him, I don't think. His history's at Fort Bliss. We need to start opening things up a little bit. Right now, this is all managed pretty much from the West Wing. I can assure you of that. That the Attorney General and the West Wing of the White House is pretty much pulling the strings on everything that's said. You never hear, if you want to know what happened, they say, we may never know what happened. We may never know what happened. Well, what I say is, we're not going to know what happened, because the people who know are the directors of psychiatry at Fort Hood and Fort Bliss, and they aren't talking.
Well, they're also the military, above and beyond being a medical person.
They're in uniform. There isn't anybody in uniform talking, without authorization from the press secretary in the West Wing.
How did you do the research for your book? I mean, you're trying to get very sensitive information that obviously people don't want to talk about, and basically saying, admit their mistakes and their problem.
I do it like just the way I got this Facebook. I read the newspapers, and I have no... Well, I shouldn't say that. I do have access to inside information, which I respect. But it does inform me, and it kind of points the way where to go. I know, for example, that the first Fort Hood shooting may not have been that damaging to the United States military, but it was extremely damaging to the United States military psychiatry. That I know.
Right. Because they're scrambling to defend themselves at that point.
They lost some really good people as a result of that.
Mm-hmm.
And people that were hard to replace. And people that had a lot of... They had all been deployed. They were uniformed psychiatrists, et cetera. But, I think that... the military, of course, is somewhat like the Catholic Church, I guess. I mean, it's a top-down organization. It's got its own rules and, like, canon law.
Yeah, but I can choose not to be represented by the Catholic Church. I can't choose not to be represented by this band of criminals that just invade everybody willy-nilly.
Yeah, but what they'll say now is that you can choose whether to go in the military, too, and that's the problem. And I don't think that's proving to be a good policy.
No.
That's just my opinion. I wished I had another solution. I think Eisenhower had it right in 1966, and I think he'd be saying the same thing today.
Well, I guess so, and I hope you're right. Unfortunately, we're almost out of time, and I just have to comment on the Eisenhower comment. I totally agree with what he said. I also agree with his famous speech upon leaving about the military-industrial complex, and it's a wonderful speech, and people should go back and listen to it and understand that what he said was a prediction and has happened. My disrespect for him as a man is that he told us these things after he was in a position to do anything about it. And as wonderful as what he said was in 1966, he wasn't the president anymore. And as wonderful as what he said about the military-industrial complex, he was out the door. It would have served us a lot better to get the news on day one and go, oh, well, we can't have this then. I mean, these guys, the ones that are honest, they're always telling us after the fact. And that needs to change. But hopefully books like yours will bring us to a place where we can absorb all of the facts inside and maybe affect change that can prevent us from being potential sitting ducks for some mental breakdown guy who's going to spray us all with, you know, bullets. That's where they've left us.
I hope you're right. It's a step, and it's going to be, you know, with the way they're spinning this, you know, just some kind of brittle guy that was trigger happy that got turned down for leave. You know, they're recruiting us as psychiatrists to go work at Fort Hood all the time. You know, and, you know, who wants to go work in a situation like that if the military is correct that there are people like that walking around? Now, if you want to tell me, hey, we've got some sick people here that we're working with, I'll go.
Yeah, that's a whole different...
If you tell me... Oh, this has nothing to do with their medical care, that this is just the way a couple of guys are around here, I'm not going to go.
Yeah, well, I think that's what you're going to see, because when it comes to telling the truth before making some kind of an operation, the military doesn't have the best track record, really.
First thing to go in war is the truth.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for coming on, Dr. John Liebert, author of the book Wounded Minds, Understanding and Solving the Growing Menace of Post-Traumatic Stress Disorder. Thanks very much for coming on.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Conspiracy Queries with Alan Park. Please offer comments or complaints by emailing conspiracyqueries@gmail.com or on Twitter @con_queries or at our website, conspiracyqueries.com. Thanks for listening.